Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the West Conference in Perth. It's my great pleasure to be sitting here with Anita Singhgupta. How are you doing, Anita?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for having me.
So you've been the keynote speaker here and also at another recent conference that I helped organise, the Agile Alliance Technical Conference. And your background, well, you work in rocket science and all sorts of really fun scientific things to do with space and, you know, deep water and all those type of things. So tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are.
Who am I? Let's see. So my background is aerospace engineering. So I got all my degrees in aerospace engineering. And I think my focus or my specialty has been in propulsion systems for deep space exploration and then entry, descent, and landing systems for basically slowing things down and landing on the surface of Mars, Venus, and then re-entering Earth's atmosphere. And so I've been doing that for about the past 15 years, actually. Yeah, so it's fun.
And was that always the aim to get into aerospace?
I think when I was really little, I was very impacted by watching science fiction. So I would watch reruns of Star Trek original series with my dad, and I absolutely loved Mr. Spock. And then I would watch reruns of, like, the old school Doctor Who, and I just thought the Doctor was this, you know, time-traveling alien. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. So I knew that I wanted to be involved in space exploration. It's just, as you're a kid, you don't necessarily know what the career choices are. So I was like, oh, do I want to be an astronomer, astrophysicist, aerospace engineer? And I ended up going with engineering because I felt like it was the most sort of hands-on, technology-oriented, and I would be able to get a real tangible job out of it. So that's what I ended up doing.
And so you've done some work, and most notably what you're talking about here at the conference is, you know, helping to land the rover on Mars, the Curiosity. It's part of the Curiosity mission. You show a video at the start there about the 7 minutes of terror. I can imagine all that planning. I mean, you know, years of work and down to some very short amount of time to know whether this thing works.
It's challenging, and there's almost nothing you can do about it at that point because it's all basically a predetermined sequence of events. So all the design and all the margins and all the philosophy that went into it at that point, you know, once it gets launched off of Earth, and it's going to go in its one-way journey, hopefully to safely land on the surface of the planet.
And so you're talking about in the talk, I guess really, and we're an agile podcast, and we often, you know, talk about, you know, experimentation and, you know, getting things and putting them out there. This is a big bang implementation in the case of, you know, what we often talk about in software, where you've got one chance and one chance only. It's not you can hit the rewind button when this thing's cavorting through space, right?
It's true. So that's the reason why we can't necessarily go through cycles in the same way, like as a product launch, but we do go through design cycles, and then we also are able to benefit from all the prior missions that went before us. So we build off of knowledge and designs that already do exist and make them basically more efficient, more capable. Sometimes we have to do something game-changing. So for the Curiosity mission, the game-changing aspect was the use of the sky crane, but that was necessary because the rover was so much heavier and we required more landing precision. But then we go through design cycles at sort of like the subsystem level as a means of being able to learn and make it better and better until you finally finish the design, build the hardware, integrate it with the rest of the system, and then go and land.
So, you're talking about some of the experiments that you do. Like you're talking about, you showed the video of the parachute. Obviously, all the different parts of the descent, you know, would have had things. How many iterations would have you gone through in a typical part of that landing procedure?
So the overall architecture, we did trades initially to decide whether or not we were going to do it. There's different things you can do. One, which the Mars Exploration Rover mission uses, they used solid rocket motors followed by airbags to do the terminal descent. So we looked at a trade doing that. Another mission in the past did retro rockets all the way to the surface, which was Viking and Phoenix. We did a trade looking at that. So we finally down-selected from an architecture perspective, probably after, you know, maybe about a year or so to go with the sky crane approach. But within each sub-phase, you also do a lot of trades in terms of what material am I going to use for the heat shield, what material am I going to use for the parachute, how big should the parachute be. So there's a couple of year design process where you're going through that trade space before you finally hone in on an architecture.
And some of the talks at this conference, for example, one of the other ones this morning after you, was talking about this safe-to-fail environment. I'm assuming that when you're part of this big mission, that whilst you want everything to go right on the night, it's almost part of the accepted culture that you are going to have things that aren't going to naturally find, right? You want to find those problems as early as possible. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yes, that's definitely true. And so part of what you do with analysis and testing on prototypes first, so we go through several iterations. That actually is a good way to describe it. So you'll go through a prototype, then you'll go through an engineering model, and then finally you end up with the flight unit, which sometimes you may actually test the flight unit, or you'll build a flight and a flight spare and you test a flight spare. So with the parachute, for example, you build a flight and a flight spare and you test a flight spare. So you do have to go through that cycle so that you can learn along the way of does your design, is it strong enough, right? Is it performing the way that it should? And it gives you opportunity to fix it and make it better. Mm. And failure really isn't failure when you're going through the design process. It's a lesson learned in how you can make a more efficient and a more robust system.
Mm. And I could imagine as an engineer, which is your background, this must be the perfect place to use those engineering skills, because you really are, you mentioned it in the talk, you're really working on complex problems, and that's what gets you guys up in the morning.
It's true, and I think when you're doing something for the first time or in a different way, which makes it the first time, you have to come up with sort of like out-of-the-box solutions, and so that's where it's sort of like a kid in the candy store of engineering when you come up with these really complicated systems, and they have to be complicated just because of the precision, the fact that it has to work the first time. So definitely, I think it's a very enjoyable environment mm-hmm. to work in as an engineer, and it's definitely multidisciplinary engineering, so it takes many people in the village of engineering to be able to pull something like this off, so that also makes it fun too, just working in that chair.
Because one of the things I think that I took away when I first saw your talk a couple of years ago was I sort of just walked out and went, well, everything I've just done for the last 15 years kind of seems insignificant. And I think about some of the wicked problems that we talk about, and they pale in comparison to some of the things you must have to deal with, particularly when you've got such a long lead time, because it was 11 months for a spacecraft to actually get to Mars. And we look at some of the incredible things that even some of the very early spacecraft, the ones that are now flying past Pluto and that the engineering that goes into that is just incredible.
It is, and I think you really have to understand the problem inside and out in order for it to last as long as it needs to last. So I think part of it is just making it work, and then the other part of it is making it last for several years, depending upon what the mission is. But yeah, like New Horizons to Pluto, I mean, it took them 10 years to get to Pluto. So, and there's no way that you can actually do a 10-year life test before you launch to show that your thing's going to last 10 years. You really have to understand how every single component in your system is going to work. But I think, I think for me, at least, I think, exploring space is one of the neatest things that we can do as a species, just because it taps into so many different technology areas, expertise areas, and we're able to make it come together and solve really complex and fascinating problems. But it takes everybody, right? So it takes software, it takes the scientists, it takes all the different engineering disciplines. So without all of those things going on in the whole commercial side, right, of everything else that's going on the planet, none of these things would happen, right? We benefit from all the different sectors going on. And we just pull them to a unique application for this particular aerospace application.
Yeah, and I'm for one glad we have Tang and all those type of things that came out of the, the space mission, and pens that write upside down in zero gravity. Do you think we'll get a man on Mars in our lifetime?
I do, actually. I really do. I think there are technology challenges, but as long as we have the resources and then the right people working on them, hopefully, not just a multiple space agency approach, sort of like a global approach to solving the problem, I think it will happen. Because I think we know what the areas are where we have technology gaps, so now we just have to go off and invest in technologies to make them work. And we're already doing that in some cases. So we're developing new heat shield technologies. We're developing new aerodynamic decelerator technologies. Every time we do another mission to Mars, we make our model better for aerodynamics, computational fluid dynamics, structural analyses, understanding the properties of the actual atmosphere. So we're always making incremental steps to getting there. And I do think it's going to happen in our lifetimes.
Oh, awesome. It's interesting that when you look at NASA and the American space program, that they've been the only ones to successfully get a mission to Mars. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Is there something different, I don't know, culturally wise, or just the way the space agency is set up in that respect that says why they've been more successful in your mind?
We probably had more time being able to do it, so that's probably more the case, right? Because we've done it, been doing it since 1970s, so it's always easier when you do something the second time. It's always the hardest when you do something the first time. But I think where we should get around all of that is that we should work together, right? So why not pool our resources, pool our expertise, and then we can do, single missions where we have multiple collaborators and accomplish the same goal, but for a lot less money because it's shared across multiple countries.
And so, interestingly, since working on the Mars lander, which you were talking about today, you've been doing some really interesting stuff, both to do with the space station in relation to cold atom research, as well as going to the depths of the ocean as well. With the space station, I mean, is that truly a shared entity, or are the things we're doing still very much segmented by the countries and their space agencies?
So the space station is a good example of international partnership. And so when you want to send, when you want to send a payload up there, you don't. You can basically go in the Japanese module, you can go in the European module, you can go in the U.S. module. So in that sense, it is very much a shared space. The way it's operated in a shared way. So I think that's a good example. I think we should take it to the next level and partner on missions which go into deep space.
And tell us a little bit about the new research that you're doing in relation to the space station.
Okay, so it's a atomic physics experiment / multi-user facility. It's called the Cold Atom Laboratory. And so the purpose of this facility is actually to create something called a Bose-Einstein condensate, but to create it in microgravity. And so what a Bose-Einstein condensate is an ultra-cold quantum gas. So you actually use a technique called laser cooling to cool down the atoms to a temperature just above absolute zero, and then interesting things start to happen when you get down to these low temperatures. Matter starts to behave in a orderly fashion versus a random fashion, and things like superfluidity, superconductivity, all of these weird sort of funky properties that happen to matter at these cold temperatures, we want to understand them better. And so by doing this technique in a microgravity environment, we can get an order of magnitude colder and essentially operate in a regime that we've never done before. So it's kind of almost unknown what it is that we're going to see, but we're certainly going to learn a lot.
What sort of things would we, what can we learn from that? Is it perhaps that we can find new ways of constructing metals, or is it about being able to go to places that are further away from Earth? Or
so there's several potential things, and so it is done for the fundamental physics of it. So we actually have five different investigation teams who had to compete to be able to use the facility. So one investigation team is going to look at something called FMLAB physics, and that team's actually led by Eric Cornell, who's a Nobel Prize winner in physics. And so what they're going to look at is how complexity arises in the universe. So people understand single particle physics really well, like how electrons behave, how protons behave, how photons behave, and they understand how really enormous systems behave, like how does the sun, the moon, and the Earth interact with each other, for the most part at that point, macroscopically as gravitationally. What we don't understand is everything in between. So one of the experiments that he's going to do is create something called a Feshbach molecule. It's basically a molecule that we create using the BECs, and we see how they'll start interacting with each other. So that'll be our first way of seeing, sort of in a macroscopic sense, how, when you take it one level up from single particle physics, how you start to interact with each other from a collisional perspective, from a gravitational perspective. So it's giving sort of this macroscopic insight into typically microscopic processes, because these Bose-Einstein condensates are actually quite large, that you could actually see them. So you actually can see atomic physics behavior at the subatomic level because you're creating this macroscopic, basically, super molecule is the way you can think of it.
That's so cool. And I suspect, again, the engineering challenges on doing that, the fact that you're trying to build something to get that temperature so low, and then but something you've also got to make sure can sit up in a space station must be.
Yes, it turned out to be a very complicated laser optomechanical problem. So the way you get out most of the temperature, so temperature is a measure of speed, and so we use a technique called laser cooling where we actually fire lasers at something to cool it down. It seems somewhat counterintuitive, but we actually push on the atoms to slow them down using laser light. And so you have to have really finely, precisely aligned laser beams in order to make this happen, like on the order of microns, 1 × 10⁻⁶ meters. So that turned out to be a pretty good engineering challenge in terms of the alignments, the mechanical structure that goes around it, and then, sensitivity to vibration loads from launch vehicles, and then thermal variations as well. The one thing I should probably add to the other thing that we're looking at is the nature of gravity. So people know that gravity's there, but they don't really know what gravity is. So it's not a particle force as far as we know. It's the curvature of space-time. And so, and there's an incompatibility between the theory of basically quantum theory and gravitational theory. The two actually don't link up with each other. So one of the tests that we're going to be doing is basically a test of the gravitational equivalence principle. And so there's the famous experiment where Galileo dropped two different balls of two different masses off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and they hit the ground at the same rate. So we're going to do that same test, but we're going to do it over a period of around 10 miles because the atom clouds are going to be moving in orbit around Earth inside the space station. So we'll be able to do that test to a higher level of precision as well. So, and the other thing which is interesting, but it's more of a technology aside, is that these Bose-Einstein condensates are incredibly sensitive to different types of fields. They're sensitive to gravitational fields, magnetic fields, electric fields. So it actually serves as a really precise sensor. So if you can demonstrate the technologies to say, this is how I create one of these BECs on board a spacecraft, then we can use that in the future as a sensor so we can determine, map out what the gravity is around a different planet, or map out what the magnetic field is around a different planet, or actually use it to improve our inertial sensing capabilities so we can have more precise entry systems, for example, to get to the place where we really want to get to on Mars. So there's technology as well as the fundamental physics applications associated with it.
Wow. The last thing I sort of wanted to ask you about, and it's something you alluded to before as well as in your talk, is that you mentioned before that working together is a really important part, and coming back to this being an agile podcast, even though I could nerd out with you on science all day, is that one of the things we often look for when we work in agile teams is making sure we bring people to collaborate and work together and get that diversity of thought, and that's something that when following you and the things you've been doing over the last few years is something that you were also a strong advocate and believer in. How are we doing in your field from a point of view of diversity?
So I think the problem is, and we were talking about this a couple of nights ago with some of the other speakers at the conference, is getting enough people into the pipeline from underrepresented groups, whether it be women or minorities. And I think we're still not making enough progress there. So it's hard to know how to fix that. One thing I think we can do on how to fix that is to do more public outreach. So try and take ourselves as professionals in the STEM fields and go and speak to school children, basically at the middle school level, high school level, to tell them that this is a great career option. It's enjoyable to do. Then you get more people into the pipeline, going into undergraduate, and then eventually making their way into the workforce. But I think it's so much more enjoyable to work in diverse teams. I think you come up with more interesting solutions when you work in diverse teams. But we have to get more people into the pipeline, which means making careers in computer science and engineering more palatable. And I think the best people to do that are people like us.
Mm. Absolutely. And I think one of the things I really love the way you said it is that when we talk about diversity and working with people from different backgrounds, we know about the needing to get more females in tech, and that's a great thing. But when we're looking at diversity of thought, also for different cultures, I think that's something that we often don't think about enough as well. And
it's true, because you live in your own universe, and it's just interesting because when you intersect with other universes, you learn so much. So if you think about it, any other avenue in your life, like what do you like to do when you go out to eat? You want to have all different kinds of food. What kind of music do you want to listen to? All different kinds of music, right? So having that diversity just makes life more enjoyable. So there's no reason why you wouldn't want that in the workplace too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I could talk to you for hours, but I know you have to go and catch a plane. So it's been great catching up with you. If people want to find out more about what you're doing and all the cool stuff, where can they find out more about you on the?
I'm active on social media, so you can tweet me at Dr_Astro, and then I'm also active on Facebook and stuff like that. But if you Google me, you can probably find my information too. So, and I usually respond more to tweets than I do to Facebook messages on my Facebook page. So I would say Twitter is probably the best way to reach me.
And what about and very briefly, you were talking about stuff going into the ocean as well. You're doing some work there. Very briefly, what's that all about?
So one of the next places that we would love to go is Europa, which is the ice moon of the Jovian system, the Jupiter system. And we do know that Europa actually has a liquid ocean beneath, but unfortunately it's underneath an up to 10-kilometer thick layer of ice. So we're looking to see what it's going to take from a technology perspective to be able to melt and or drill through that ice to get down to the liquid ocean below. And so we're just starting out on that now, and it's more focused on the technologies associated with that. Mm-hmm. And I'll definitely be keeping people up to date via social media to see where we're headed with that. But it's one of the most exciting destinations in our solar system.
Wow, awesome. And what sort of time frame are they thinking for a mission there?
So there's a Europa Clipper mission, which is going to be an orbiter, and that's supposed to launch in the 2022 timeframe. So for something which would be a landed mission is probably a few years after that. So we'll benefit from the data which is collected by the Europa Clipper mission because it should have a ice penetrating radar, which will give us a better idea of what the composition and the thickness of the ice is, but hopefully within, before 2030.
Awesome. Well, thank you for flying the flag for engineering. Thank you for flying the flag for diversity. And more importantly, thank you for helping us go and make sure that we know that there's more out there than just, you know, what we can see in this one planet. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for having me. And yeah, I honestly think that space exploration is probably the most unifying thing that we can do, because we realize that we're all Earthlings, right, as opposed to all these different groups that we think we are. We're actually just Earthlings floating around on spaceship Earth, hopefully going to explore other planets.
Absolutely. There's one last thing we do at the end of the podcast. We are the Agile Revolution, so we normally close by saying Viva la Revolution. Would you like to join me in that?
Okay.
All right, on the count of 3, 1, 2, 3. Viva la Revolution. Thank you so much.
Sure. That's cute.